The longest, shortest month. In honor of this being the last weekend of February, thank the Lord. What was your favorite February movie release from any year? Feel free to use Google.
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with The Wedding Singer, which came out February 13th, 1998, because it played a major part in a lot of slumber parties I was having at the time, and I probably saw it 6 times in theaters.
And it's me, DA, with a 7. I'm going to go with Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, February win from 1994.
I'm Matt Patches, and Katie, get out of my ear, because I'm picking Dark City from February 27th, 1998, a really kooky, crazy sci-fi movie that I still love.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm picking The Passion of the Christ. I'm just kidding. I'm picking Like Someone in Love, which came out 2 weeks ago on February 15th, 2013, because I'm too lazy to Google past this year, and that movie's fucking amazing.
There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
This week on Operation Kino, episode 103 for Tuesday, February 26, 2013, we are talking about experimental documentaries such as Leviathan. We're talking about Oscilloscope Pictures' amazing stunt to use Vine for their PR. We've got a listener voicemail to ask us to talk about Star Wars. And we're talking about trolling on the internet and whether or not it's legitimate, and Dave will probably get angry about it.
You know, what you catch, and for me it felt like a found footage movie, almost, like a horror movie following a sea monster, this boat traveling through the water and catching all the fish and destroying them, just chewing them up, because there's a lot of scenes where the camera's underwater and you see the chum of the fish. Okay, so the other night I saw a documentary film that I knew very little about. I think I had seen a trailer for it right before the New York Film Festival last year, and now it is finally coming out. So it is called Leviathan, and it is directed by two gentlemen, Lucien Casting Taylor and Verena Paravel.
Does Verena sound like a guy to you, Patches?
I don't. Maybe. Verena, a man and a woman, two women, two extraordinary filmmakers.
This sounds crazy.
Two artists. They're definitely art-driven over conventional Hollywood filmmakers or something. Whatever. It doesn't. You get the picture. The point is, they made this film Leviathan, and it is about its goal is to demystify the fishing industry, the contemporary fishing industry, which they in their notes in their director's statement claim has been kind of elevated to mythical levels through, you know, Moby Dick and literature, film, that sort of thing. And basically, they planted a lot of cameras around this ship. For a week-long journey going fishing with a bunch of guys who spend their days setting out nets, catching lots of fish and cutting them up and throwing them in bins and come back with loads and loads of fish or manta rays and all sorts of things. They're just going out into the ocean and coming back, and it's a bloody, gruesome job that someone's got to do. And I thought it was fairly extraordinary. David, did you see this film at New York Film Festival?
No, I've missed out on several occasions to see this, and I dread seeing it for the first time on a screener on DVD or something, so I'm hoping I make it out once it hits theaters.
Definitely a film I would recommend seeing on the big screen, if only because the image and the directors describe their style as kaleidoscopic, and that's extremely fitting because they really kind of set their camera down, and they must be using very tiny cameras because a lot of them are planted on the ropes and chains of fishing nets, and the camera's constantly going underwater or flashing up above the water and catching the birds swooping over the boat or being in the fish net as the fish are flopping around dying because they're out of the water. And it's a very trippy experience. And the nice thing about it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, no,
what was that? Question, which is what makes this different from having the Discovery Channel and watching like Alaskan crab fishermen go out?
Right. Well, I think the perfect.
You mean Deadliest Catch?
Right. The reason this isn't Deadliest Catch is because this is not necessarily about the people. It very wisely, I think, gets away from turning these people into characters in a bigger narrative. It's very much a fly-on-the-wall experience. There's very little dialogue, pretty much no dialogue, and the imagery is very loose and you know, what you catch. And for me, it felt like a found footage movie almost, like a horror movie following a sea monster, this boat traveling through the water and catching all the fish and destroying them, just chewing them up, because there's a lot of scenes where the camera's underwater and you see the chum of the fish and the guts and the blood flowing out of the boat as they just, like, chop the heads off. We'll keep the tails or something, throw everything back into the ocean. You know, they take machetes to manta rays and throw the bodies back and keep the fins. It's a gruesome experience, and it's really they play fast and loose with the imagery, because really it seems like they just kind of planted the cameras and let them run and caught what they caught and edited together with very little intrusion into what those cameras naturally caught. And it got me thinking a lot about, you know, I took experimental documentary classes in film school, and I think my professor at NYU is the first person who hits Google at the top of Google when you Google experimental documentary. And, you know, kind of a crazy lady who I probably didn't understand enough when I was actually in school, but looking back and looking at something like this and the power of kind of just letting it fly, letting the imagery go and seeing what you capture and deciding the story later, as opposed to what I see a lot in documentary film, which is too perfect in some ways. Like, they already know what they want out of this documentary. And what I like about Leviathan is that it seems like it had to be constructed after the fact, because they really wanted to be a fly on the wall.
But you don't think that they knew sort of what they were getting, that they had done sort of test shoots, or they added a general feel of the kind of things they would get, and if that they had the cameras affixed to the ship for long enough, they would be able to make the sort of documentary that they had intended?
I think they certainly knew what imagery, you know, they knew what was going to happen on the boat, how they would frame it and catch it, and how it would eventually connect together to create this experience. I don't think you can plan. The way at least I experienced the film, it doesn't feel that way. It feels extremely organic. And I feel like if they captured those moments in the right way at the right time, it would feel like one of those food documentaries, one of the 8,000 food documentaries that are on Netflix telling me why if I eat a burger, I'm going to die in like 5 years.
Oh, that kind of food. I was thinking of Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which is
no.
Interesting.
Not
thing.
A foodie doc, a fear the food kind of thing. this doesn't feel like muckraking or something, you know what I mean? Which it doesn't feel calculated. And when we were pre-discussing this topic, I kind of mentioned that this fast, loose nature, spontaneity, I just wish I could see more of that in all different types of film, especially considering something that – the fact that this movie reminded me of a found footage movie where you'd think that there might be more spontaneity, but those films – that genre has so quickly been sucked dry of all life and soul and just like there's nothing to discover there.
Yeah, I think that this is – I mean the truth of the matter is that a lot of the time in almost, you know, more or less every film you've ever seen, aside from something like Russian Ark, there are moments of profound spontaneity that make it onto the screen that are invisible, that you simply – because you were not there on the day or aren't, you know, perfectly aware of the filmmaker's intentions, aren't attuned to. I think this, to me, sounds like more of a reflection of the current state of popular documentary films, with things like Searching for Sugar Man and things whose deceptions are predicated upon narratives that have been predetermined to the point where they're sort of more plot-driven and you can see the seams a little bit better, and everything feels so clean because that's how they feel like they need to sell them. Like, a movie like Searching for Sugar Man doesn't need to feel as clean as it does. It can be a little bit more raw and loose, but that's not the package that they chose for it. And I think that you're sort of just lashing it against that, and rightly so.
Just to stem off of what you're saying, we talked about two documentaries on this podcast before, The Gatekeepers, which is nominated for an Oscar along with Searching for Sugar Man, which to me is overly produced and there's just nothing there. Like, I'm not getting into the topic. My hands are digging into the dirt here. I'm just kind of stalely witnessing people telling stories, and like, I even think a talking head can be more organic than something like The Gatekeepers is able to produce. Whereas a film that was on my top 10 of last year, Call Me Cuchu, yes, it's born of the Verite style because these guys are just living there. But as we were kind of pre-discussing, I think there's a difference here between just Verite and spontaneous action and feeling where the camera should be, or in the case of Leviathan, allowing the camera to just go where it does and through editing end up finding the right moments and showing me whatever the camera caught at that exact moment to make it feel as natural as possible, if that makes sense. That there's a difference between Verite camera action, which we have seen evolve into narrative film, you know, Paul Greengrass to the extreme once that documentary shaky cam feel, which everyone loves now. There's a difference between that and spontaneity with the camera and playing loose. I don't know if that makes sense or if you see a difference there.
It sort of sounds like to me is that you're reacting to having, I don't know, spent some time with reality television and sort of the common vernacular.
I certainly haven't the way you have.
Well, I was going to say, Dave, what would you know about reality television?
Well, I mean, but just the sort of the vernacular of what a documentary series or movie is has been stretched to include, you know, Catfish that, you know, does a Sundance and starts this whole, like, weird debate about what it is. But what you're talking about, Patch, is what it sounds like is you're like letting the camera go somewhere on a ship is really just letting that thing be and sort of be observed. And it's sort of like the least amount of change based on the observation. Whereas we're used to now seeing documentaries that are so narratively imposing. I don't think what you're really looking for is spontaneity. You're just looking for moments of truth that don't feel like they're being served to you all the time.
Well, it's such a visceral reaction watching Leviathan, whether I'm being pulled under the ocean and then thrusted back up into the air as the boat kind of goes back and forth on the water, or if I'm kind of planted at the bottom and I'm watching fish wiggle around as they suffocate and one of them kind of comes near camera and bumps into it or something, you know, it's by planting them there and finding the moments through editing, it feels more visceral to me. And maybe that's what I'm lacking. And
but if those were people, they just would have had the people do it over and over again until they found the one. It's just because it's nature. Your body thinks, like, this is spontaneous and this is, you know, whatever. But
not only that, because the framing ends up being spontaneous, too. Like, I can follow an actor and allow that actor to do anything, but if I force my camera into one locked position and then they kind of float in and out and I don't allow myself to follow them, that adds something.
Patches, I want to ask quickly, I know we're about to wrap. Have you seen How to Survive a Plague?
I have.
I mean, I feel like the footage in that movie, even though it's archival footage, it has a lot of what you're talking about, where it's people who are not professional cameras kind of getting out there and capturing what's happening in this way that nobody really expected to be used in a documentary. I think that's a lot of the power of that movie.
Yeah, I think if How to Survive a Plague had been all that footage, I would have been really interested. I think that's a great film, but I would have been interested. What if that film had just been that archival footage, maybe with some voiceover or something, or not at all, like just cut that footage up? What would that experience have been like?
Mm-hmm. I think we're going to use this as an example of a new feature of our format, which is that tidbits can be tabled and brought
come
up again. So we're all going
to
look into some more documentaries for Patches, and when we all feel we're better educated, we'll be back on this topic. But for now,
thank you, Teacher Dave.
Let's move on.
And it ruined them and ruined their hopes for this film. And it was a very funny press release that obviously ties into the title of the film being It's a Disaster. And it was just a lot of fun. I mean, it obviously, Oscilloscope is a smaller label. They're a smaller boutique label. They're not Sony or you know, Fox and one of the big guys. And so they can afford to have this sort of fun. So over the past couple days, there was an interesting and novel promotional campaign that was run by Oscilloscope for their new apocalyptic comedy, It's a Disaster, which I've heard nothing but good to glowing things about since it started premiering in corners of the festival circuit last year, and was picked up by Oscilloscope for a release, I think, in April of this year. And what they did, which I didn't really put the pieces together in my head because I was distracted in 12 different ways until it was over, but what they did was they took the entire film and they released it in 6-second increments on Vine. And the following day, after lots of eyebrows were raised and very earnest news stories were written about it that took it quite seriously, there was Oscilloscope released a press release saying that it was effectively an unqualified disaster. And that they had thought that they had this visionary plan of being the setting the future for film PR and releasing films on Vine in 6-second increments, and that it had just been a complete, you know, it had ruined them and ruined their hopes for this film. And it was a very funny press release that obviously ties into the title of the film being It's a Disaster. And it was just a lot of fun. I mean, it obviously, Oscilloscope is a smaller label. They're a smaller boutique label. They're not Sony or you know, Fox and one of the big guys, and so they can afford to have this sort of fun. And it really, I think, brought, for those who were willing to go along with it and check back the following day and have their suspicions confirmed that this was sort of done with good humor.
You should describe what the actual vines looked like.
I didn't watch them.
You didn't watch them?
No, I refused to watch it.
Oh, I did.
I mean, I think that's sort of irrelevant to where we're going with this, which was to talk less about Vine and more about the idea of studios, small and large, or you know, distribution labels, small and large, embracing humor and novelty and fun, and really just letting down their old guard, which I feel is so antagonistic and stiff-lipped, to engage with a new crowd and really set the right precedent and tone for their films. Because I feel like I haven't seen It's a Disaster, but this feels in line with the spirit of that movie. And I feel like the larger studios, when I see their advertorial campaigns, and obviously they have a much greater responsibility financially, but it's so severe and it's so strict, and it really sucks the air right out. Everything feels like a sell job that isn't done with the right or earnest intentions. It doesn't feel like it's done by humans. It feels like it's done by this giant machine, which, well, in a way, it is. And so what I'm saying is that, you know, like, we should – is there an opportunity for the larger outfits to humanize this sort of effort?
Here's why I think describing what Oscilloscope did exactly is important. The Vine videos that they released, which are these six-second videos, they were taping a television that was in their office, mm-hmm. which you could tell. It looked like shit on purpose, and just having low-quality, low-volume clips of It's a Disaster going every other minute that they were just incessantly tweeting out. It was just rapid fire, and they looked terrible. And I think what I got from that was, look, there's real people who are trying to put this movie in front of you.
Right.
Yes.
Huh. And that's what I got out of, you know, there's someone filming It's a Disaster right now, bit by bit. And there's someone who wants you to see this movie. And there's someone who cares enough to put on this absurd show for us. And while it, you know, Katie and I were talking about it as it was happening, and Katie kind of thought it was ludicrous. And for me, I thought, like, well, no one's supposed to be watching It's a Disaster
right.
over Vine in 6-second bits. But the fact that an outlet like Mashable, which is a huge internet, you know, journalistic, whatever
Force.
They are, they, I don't know what they write about. They write about whatever they care about that hits the internet big. And Oscilloscope got to be in that spotlight
right,
for
but
a
it's
second
not that
because
it was
of this
just
insane.
Right, but
insane
it's not
venture.
That it was just a gimmick, but it was like some upstart filmmakers who were like, oh, here's a clever way of doing it. No, beyond that, what I'm saying is that it actually has effect because it's from a label large enough to put out a film like It's a Disaster. It's not some random kid who's like, oh, here's this clever idea I have of promoting my film. It's from a very respectable and substantial, you know, player in this industry. And they're still having the sort of fun that would usually we would think would only be available to,
but,
you know, to much smaller independent filmmakers. And I think it's in that synthesis of the two where this becomes so appealing to me.
How do bigger movies have this same personality, show off this same human side of themselves, or dramatic movies, these small dramatic movies? You know, it's interesting that I don't know if the people listening follow roadside attractions.
Roadside tweets.
Roadside tweets on Twitter, which is just an amazing comedy account that occasionally tweets a reminder that they're putting out Mud, you know, the film from director Jeff Nichols.
The danger there is that, and I think it's brilliant. I mean, and the guy who runs the roadside attractions
very
account
guy.
Is very, very funny, and I would recommend that everybody follow it. The problem with that is that you understand, if you follow him for long enough, who he is as a person, and there can be a disconnect sometimes between the films that he has, you know, he's duty bound to promote, and what you know to be their quality. And I think Roadside does a very good job of putting out, for the most part, quality films, but there can be this sort of hint of disingenuous promotion that, you know, we just sort of it rubs because you know there's a real voice behind it. And of course, this is infinitely preferable to, you know, just a faceless corporate hack account.
Yeah.
And so I certainly don't begrudge it. But there are always pratfalls in all of these regards. And if Roadside.
But does that make you want to see the movies?
No, I mean, I follow the Roadside Attractions account as a person. I don't follow that particular account as like a promotional thing. You know, it does. Of course, we talk about Roadside Attractions. I think it works simply by virtue of existing. It doesn't have to work by calling attention to individual films. It reminds you of the distributor and the label all the time. Anyone, even more casual fans, could probably cite them by name as long as they follow the account. And they're going to be aware of the films. And so I think that overall is a good thing. But I think, you know, going back to a bigger point here, the idea of not being afraid to – I mean, I think we live in a culture that's so afraid. You see this whole Applebee's disaster from last month with that whole thing – about the firing, the whatever, you don't need to go into it. But the point being that corporations are so afraid of the public that I feel they're afraid to have a personality. And that can be true of giant restaurant chains, which don't cook their food on site. And it can be true of, you know, companies that put out movies.
Well, it's worth crediting Oscilloscope that they've had that kind of personality in a lot of what they've done. I mean, the Vine stunt is more extreme, but I mean, their press releases, every single one of them are funny.
Right. And it was it was founded by one of the Beastie Boys. I mean, this is not, it would have been very strange had they, you know, adopted a more corporate mentality. But I'm hoping that people like this can really spread that flavor far and wide. I mean, I feel it now. I think, you know, a lot of us can speak to this. When we run Twitter accounts for our websites that are ostensibly supposed to be objective feeds. You say like, oh, here's this article, and they're supposed to drum up attention and page views. But I feel and I'm still trying to figure out how best to do this, but I want to give it a voice. I want to give it a personality. Like I think the Playlist does a good job of this, where they have a number of different writers manning the account, and they sign their tweets. But as a result of that, they're not afraid to put their brand behind an opinion that may not be universally appreciated. But I think it's really helpful in understanding who they are and becoming a little bit more attentive to their opinion and wanting to know whether or not I should care what they have to say and read their articles. So, I mean, I think what I'm just saying is that, like, personality has never had more avenues to make itself known than it does now. And I feel like people that have skin in the game are more and more afraid of backlash and rubbing people the wrong way and all the sorts of things that I'm thinking that people need to embrace that, because the strength of if you have a solid brand and it's going to be attractive to the right people, it's our audience you're targeting. And Oscilloscope is targeting smart, self-aware movie lovers. So this works very well for them. They're not targeting the lowest common denominator. That you need to embrace that if you're going to be able to survive and actually have your social networking efforts be worthwhile.
Social networking efforts. David, you've gotten so engaged with all this shit that we've been caring about forever. I'm so proud of you.
I know.
Yeah, it's like someone's paying him to pay attention now.
Why do we talk about trailers?
Well, no, but I mean, I'm responding now to the same flags that went up in my head when I would hear people talk about this before. Where it's like I'm trying to figure out how to do it on terms that make sense to me and not just concede and concede and concede. And I think that the people at Oscilloscope are probably facing the same dilemma for their particular business. And they, I think with It's a Disaster, at least, they've had a really neat way of negotiating it to the point where I didn't even have to watch the damn Vine videos to think that they did a really neat job.
Yeah. All I know is that I went through an entire Ash Wednesday without seeing anything new from the new Evil Dead. And I was like, someone messed up over there.
Not everything can be based on puns, Dave.
But it should be.
It's free. It's free PR. That's what David's talking about. Just, like, send out a tweet. Tweet one of the things you find on Facebook. Give some fan and some attention. It can't be bad.
Well, it can be bad, but...
All right. I think that does it for that.
And now it's time for Mailbag, the segment where we get input from you, the listeners, and respond to it as us, the podcasters.
Hey gang, this is Kevin Hutchison, the best Captain K on Twitter. And I was just curious about something, because after today's bland Star Wars spinoff news, I started to wonder about staleness in the film industry. And it feels like every time I look at a new, quote-unquote, big multiplex film, it's an adaptation, remake, etc. of something, and it's already got a franchise in mind. And I just wonder if we'll ever reach another day where multiple original films are released to big grosses that only then have sequels planned. And I'm curious if you guys think that something like Pacific Rim could be the answer. Thanks.
Thanks, best Captain K, for first voicemail.
He's calling the right people to complain about Star Wars news, that's for
grumble,
sure.
Grumble, grumble, grumble.
I think that might have been an oversimplification of what he's talking about.
No, that is true.
He's reacting to the post-Avengers world, which we're all kind of getting used to, which is movies are now coming with, like, 7 sequels planned, backing them up. Which I think, if I could boil down his question, he's asking if we're ever going to get back to single ones that maybe have a sequel if it does well enough.
We are so far down the, like, franchise rabbit hole that we pine to go backwards to the time when it was just 1, 2, 3 trilogy.
Yeah.
But now there's, like, webs of movies. There's worlds.
Webs like Spider-Man, you might say.
God. Yeah.
If that's another conversation we could have dovetailed into what we were just talking about with the oscilloscope, is them, you know, premiering these photos via Instagram and whatnot, and that's another rabbit hole that we don't need to go down.
Well, I feel like this whole situation can only implode. Like, how many worlds can you build? I mean, yes, we will suffer through a decade of this. And I don't say suffer because I'll probably enjoy some of them along the way, as I did Avengers. But I don't feel like you can continue to world build forever. But then again, Dave and the Latino Review crew may prove me wrong there. If plans for 2018... remain intact.
Oh my God!
If you trust Latino entertainment reporters,
I mean, those Latinos wear jackets. I mean, I think what he's asking is a simpler question, though. I mean, obviously the franchise rabbit hole is killing us all slowly. But I mean, talking about just original movies that come out and only have sequels planned after. I mean, it hasn't been that long since Inception. You know, there's been big original movies that are a hit most years. I mean, this year it was Ted. You know, there's a sequel plan, but it was in the top 10, and it was an original story backed by basic star power. I mean, this happens once in a while. It's just not the focus of the internet where everyone was just – where only thing anyone wants to read about is franchises, which I deal with every day.
Right, and Pacific Rim, as excited for it as I am, feels to me, from what I can gather so far, much more of an homage than it does like a bold stab at originality. I mean, it feels like an insane stab at making money, but I don't know how that's going to work out for them. But it feels, you know, you look at the kaiju monsters and the Neon Genesis Evangelion, you know, influence, and it feels maybe like Guillermo del Toro's Tarantino movie. But
well, it almost works to our advantage that sequels are always on the horizon for nearly everything. I remember when The Fighter did really well a few years back. Everyone was saying that The Fighter 2 was going to happen. You know, it's just like,
I think Mark Wahlberg was the only one who wanted that to happen.
But I guess it means, like, after this year especially, where a lot of the films that we enjoyed in the latter half of the year have proved to be box office successes as well, not the sort of things that you can sequelize, but obviously that the audiences are hungry for, I feel like that line of thinking will kind of bleed over into summer blockbusters. I feel like we'll get original kind of prestige-type movies in the blockbuster realm, so that we can't just – because you can't just have Star Wars. and Marvel movies every year. As much as – I mean, Disney will own
they
that.
They will try.
But everyone else has to do something else. And it's funny because Universal just had this whole report a few days ago about, like, what they want to do. And obviously, they want to make blockbusters and sequels. And the saddest thing I ever read in my entire life might be, well, we have all these classic Universal monsters. And really, the only way you can make them into an action movie is to reboot Van Helsing. which, wow, that blew my mind.
It's pretty brutal.
But, I mean, at a certain point, they're going to realize that they don't have Marvel, they don't have Star Wars, they don't have these things that allow them to create these mega franchises. So they have to take a stab at original stuff. And Pacific Rim's on the right track. I think I kind of agree with David that it's born of, like, we love toys, which sounds great to a studio.
Or we love Japanese monster movies, which there's, you know, tons of
They look more like toys to me, but...
I mean, that for me, it's there will always be a place for the good tentpole movie that is just smart enough to, you know, burst out of the box and be successful. But, like, these, if everybody's in the franchise game and all these franchise movies cost X amount of dollars and they're not going to invest X amount of dollars unless they're getting three movies out of it, I wouldn't look for a whole bunch of tentpole non-franchise films for a while. Basically, we need one of these to, like, crash and burn. We need Guardians of the Galaxy to be horrible, or Justice League to bomb. We need someone to just
We need Justice League to happen to be... I mean,
Jonah
I'm still
Hex
confident
bombed,
it's happening.
And they kept making superhero movies.
Well,
but,
yeah,
but not as many Westerns.
But, like, this nexus that, like, the Avengers formula worked and you could have five movies that sprout their own mega trilogy is, like, I'm not, no one's proved it. We're just assuming that it's going to happen.
I'm skeptical that it ever will. I mean, Star Wars maybe is the exception. Yeah,
the bubble will pop.
And in the meantime, you could, like you were saying, you can look to stuff like the year's Best Picture nominees, which are all original stories, and all of them have made. I mean, Lincoln has made $175 million. That's amazing.
Your definition of original stories is a bit generous by my standards.
It is generous. They are stories that are not trying to actively set up new.
You know what the original story is? Stoker. Which I cannot.
We'll get there,
David. I just realized that it was like the first movie I had seen in ages that I loved unequivocally and was based on nothing. Fantastic.
God, that's not even till Friday, David.
I know.
Hold your horses.
That's true.
Alright, this week we're gonna try to delve deeply into trolling. I know I don't sound very sure of myself, but that's actually sort of, I don't know, comes with the territory. Here's why I wanted to talk about it this week. Trolling is when you enter a conversation, a very civil conversation between multiple people, minimum amount of two people. I don't know if you could troll people in their own head. That's up for debate.
And you can troll yourself. Self-trolling.
Let's not get too meta in the trolling before we define it. So you jump in, people are having a conversation, and somebody says something so incendiary that it attracts so much attention to that person's incendiary and usually inherently stupid comment that it blows apart any productivity the conversation would have had overall. And the reason I want to talk about it is because I think it shows up more than we're so used to it being internet commenters because we're people that spend time on the internet and write on the internet, and we occasionally have to deal with these people just professionally. But it really is something that takes place overall in, like, big picture life. Like, I keep telling people the NRA is trolling us because I, like, they don't make guns, so they're going out and saying intentionally stupid things, so we all yell about how stupid the NRA is instead of actually doing things that would help gun control law. Is that a bad example?
No, that's a really good example,
yeah,
actually.
It is.
Especially what you said at the end there about how, because I was thinking, like, why are they trolling if they have nothing to gain from it necessarily, and they're too big of an organization just to mess with us for yucks. But I think the way you cap that off makes a lot of sense, is that if we're way too busy reacting to the bullshit they spew, we are not spending our valuable time combating, you know, their actual policies.
And so part of this was a conversation that I got in a Twitter fight with one of the BuzzFeed editors about whether or not trolling could be used as like an editorial tactic to sort of shove your commenters into the right direction or sort of get the conversation back on track. She linked me to an example of one of their editors posting tweets of people who liked Nickelback, and they had sort of collected it into I'm paraphrasing, but look at all these stupid people who like Nickelback sort of post. And I guess my response is that, like, if you're from an editorial position, you're already trying to foster sort of a group conversation, or you're trying to reach out and teach somebody something. And I'm wondering if, like, an incendiary bomb is the way to do that. And, I mean, I know that we're all guilty of that, and everybody reads websites that are guilty of that. Like, watch this in all caps. You won't believe this disgusting
injury. Do you think that's trolling, or is that just clickbait?
No, but I feel like the corollary here for me is that it's the difference between, like, posting clickbait and just posting quality content that you believe in and hoping that, you know, people will find you because they start to regard you as a destination and something they want to read regularly. I mean, it's like, I feel like the honesty is the best way to go about it. And if you are honest, it is, and you're not just a flagrant conformist who has no opinions of their own, eventually you will say something that inflames someone, you can't troll if it feels insincere. I feel like if someone comes on your site and they say something that you know they are,
but take it outside writing on the web. Like, let's talk about pop culture conversations that we have with people, that everybody has with people. I mean, is trolling devil's advocacy in some way? I enjoy that to at least fuel conversation about the art, about the things that I engage with, just to provoke and see what people will say and. You know, I'd rather have the discussion by trolling them in a conversation about the movie we just saw than agree with them and not talk about
it. But I think the definition of the word trolling is what's throwing me, because
I think that we're looking for that.
Right. But I think if you're trolling, you are – I mean, I guess there are two ways of saying it. I mean, I think you're going into a place where you know you're going to just rile shit up. I mean, if you honestly believe in the NRA's policies and you go to – a very liberal website. I mean, you're picking at something, and so I guess that can qualify as trolling for sure. And then the other side of that is just saying things you know to be false or that you don't believe in yourself in order to provoke a reaction just for yucks. And I think that more often than not, we deal with the former, I guess.
I mean, I think there could be productive trolling. Like, what you're talking about, David, is, you know, like, if I specifically choose a website or a forum where I know that everybody's going to have an opinion I violently disagree with and jump in, sometimes that's how you immediately find the most opposition opinion. Like, I'm not going to find any, I'm not going to find any people who genuinely believe that homosexual people are going to hell in a LGBT like friend group. So there's no point in even trying to have that conversation. Or you could make the argument that if you're looking for the most extreme view, like trolling is the, I should make a not gay example. It's like, if I were to go into like a Criterion Cast meet and greet and insist that I was only going to talk about how The Dark Knight Rises was the best movie of last year.
But why would you do that? Like, what are you gaining from doing that?
Well, because I would be going into a room full of the smartest film people and making them basically go up to their stance of the status quo that Dark Knight Rises was a bad movie. And by doing that, I'd have to provoke them immediately because they may not take me seriously unless I come in immediately incendiary. Two devil's advocacy?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we're talking about the kind of trolling that you're talking about is when you take a group that exists out there, like a set conversation or a set group, and you get in there and you start throwing bombs. But I think the kind that I'm interested in, and we were kind of talking before we started this topic about how trolling can start conversations and be valuable. And I mean, I do this a lot to some degree when I'm trying to figure out editorials to put on the site. When you're talking to someone and they have a crazy opinion, like our writer Christy Puchko saw Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters and came back to was like, I think that movie was actually pretty great. And I was like, fine, write an article about how it's actually great. That is an opinion that's against what everyone else was holding, but it's an interesting opinion. It starts a conversation. And you can call that trolling if you want to. I mean, I think it's more nuanced than BuzzFeed's article about jazz, but it's the same kind of contrarianism.
But then maybe there's like a middle ground where it's like at the end of every year, back on movies.com, I would write an article that was like the 10 most overrated titles of the year. And of course, when you're writing anything that has the word overrated in the headline, you understand the sort of reaction that you're going to provoke. But every word that I wrote in that article is something that I sincerely believe. I'm not, I wasn't generating those opinions just to instigate people, but the purpose of the article was to rile people up. So,
well,
I
David,
mean,
I think about your, I think about your Transformers 3 review when we, you know, everyone was talking about this and everyone was like, you can't possibly believe it. And you stood by it. And it was an interesting thing. And you trolled us. I mean, it got us all going crazy about that review, but it made it a better conversation.
And I think also that if you ever fell on the other side of that line and you really stuck your neck out for something you didn't believe in simply because you enjoyed the provocation, it would immediately suck the air out of the entire thing. So I think that like the most effective trolling, you know, really falls in
you just wish,
ground.
Though, that trolling could work in a positive way, too. You wish it
you
could
don't
be
think
as
it
effective.
Can?
Well, you know, I stand by enjoying Smurfs, and I am often criticized for that opinion. But I stand against the masses, and I beg people to actually try and watch the movie before throwing down with me. And yet no one will. They'll just continue to criticize.
Are you asking us to feel sorry for you, for your Smurfs
No,
love?
I'm not.
Cry,
I mean,
for batches.
I cry at night, blue tears of Smurf.
You get elevated to trolling by consistently bringing that up, and instead of every time you bring it up being like, well, nobody's really seen it, but you could be challenging us to fucking see Smurfs.
Right, but then you have to take an attack position, and that's what's so interesting about internet trolling and pop culture trolling at this point. It's at some point it had to tip into something more sensational than just standing by your opinion and being
yes.
loud and proud about it. It had to become an attack, and we have to attack each other in order to – we have to make bold statements that say, anyone who likes this is dumb.
Yeah,
or I any – you know, and I don't know if that's healthy. And that's what worries me about like embracing trolling as an important part of the conversation as part of, even though I was kind of saying that maybe, yes, it's part of – it's important to provoke in order to have a discussion in the first place. But trolling, to me, seems like pushing it over the edge. Like, why do we want to be attacking each other?
I mean, I agree in the sense that the incendiary thing is what makes it trolling, whereas the example Katie gave earlier with Hansel and Gretel Wish Hunters is more like contrarian. But she brought up the...
But it's a fine line. You have to admit
that. Yeah, but she brought up, you brought up the BuzzFeed Jazz article, which I don't think we actually talked about, which was this article on BuzzFeed where their associate music editor just was like, I hate jazz, and had like some JPEGs with white words on it. It's like, it all sounds like a butt. And, you know, like, it has like a...
It sounds like a butt was actually her term.
What's interesting is that like... Subjectivity comes into the – sorry, Dave, go on.
The thing is that there's no way that BuzzFeed hired an associate music editor that actually can't see any, you know, redeeming quality to jazz. That
right,
just makes
which
no
is,
actual sense.
Which is where it really comes down – I mean, trolling gets trickier and trickier because the greatest and most fatal crime of that post was that it wasn't funny.
Yeah.
And I think that if – and like intentions can be lost alongside humor. I think that if that post had been even mildly effective and not completely asinine, and like, why would you hire someone who is that incapable of delivering a joke? I mean, it evinced such a lack of understanding as to how to make people laugh. Like, that was troubling to me.
But
that's the problem. And it, had it been actually funny, it could have been seen as satire and not trolling. So it might be a very hazy line.
What terrifies me about the promotion of trolling and the importance of it on the internet is that it steps away from when we're behind our computer screens. And now I engage with people I know face to face and they troll me about things. I'll be like, I loved Inception. Oh, you know, Inception has all like every plot hole you could ever imagine. Let me list them for you until your love for this thing has been reduced to nothing.
I'm going to point a finger at Dave right now. That is what he's been doing to me about Brave for months.
But that's destructive. I mean, I think that is unhealthy and destructive.
I agree.
Whereas maybe on the internet it can provoke because we need that force to be able to do it behind the wall of our computers. But when you walk away from your computer and start having conversations about pop culture with people that you know and you're still possessing that impulse to troll, that is scary. And I don't think many people realize they're carrying that.
I mean, I don't think so either, because it's people growing up in this internet culture where the loudest you have to be loud to get
noticed.
But
how do you separate it then? How do you walk away and make sure that you're not trolling people?
I mean, it's like a biblical thing, Patches. It's do unto others. I don't know if there's like a hard, fast rule, because it's difficult for me to say don't ever troll, because if the right people
you
and
certainly
the smart
can't
people
say that.
Troll.
Yeah. You are the – I think of the four of us, you are the biggest troll.
Yeah. Oh, no offense.
Definitely.
Dave.
Well, then I also have really good troll armor because I pride myself in being able to distinguish when somebody is being incendiary just to try to get me to react to them, or when they're actually being incendiary in a way that could further the conversation.
I feel like I'm just dulled down by trolling at this point. I'm like desensitized, which means it takes even more trolling to provoke me into an argument or at least an engaging conversation. I feel like I'd rather see movies that I consider to be trolling and show them to people to start conversations than me physically
trolling.
Wait,
you think the movies are actually trolling?
Yes.
Wait,
so in some ways, I think the comedy trolls, if that makes sense.
Wait, what comedy?
The comedy.
Oh, the comedy.
I showed the comedy to a group of people.
Did you see the new Gael Garcia Bernal film?
No!
Anyway, I showed the film to a bunch of people who I told them like that this may upset them, but I wanted them to see it. And it did, in fact, upset them. And the immediate reaction to all three of them after watching the comedy, they said, I hate this film. It's awful.
Yes.
And then,
welcome to me
and
in a Serbian film.
And then for an hour, we talked about it. And I'm like, this is a successful film. And at the end of that conversation, they said, yes, this is a good movie.
Wow.
It's like there's a guy who was, Film.com published a list of like the best 50 films to not win Best Picture that were nominated. And he was arguing to me that the point of a list is to talk about the films that are on it, not the ones that you're omitted, after arguing with me online for an hour about the films that are list omitted. And I was like, that is, I think, precisely speaks to what Patches was saying.
Well, it just always amazes me that sometimes we kind of shame provocateur filmmakers who are trolls at heart, who rile us up and show us things we don't want to see. And for some reason, people who love trolling on the internet can't handle being trolled by the art that they watch.
Yes.
And we have
Heaven forbid, I say shit.
Lars von Trier away.
We are not putting our podcast in among art that provokes people. I'm not doing that.
We are not Antichrist. We are not Melancholia.
Yet. Yeah, but okay, wait. How can we say we're not Antichrist, but then have an episode where like Patches basically says, if God's like he is in Soul Surfer, then
Antichrist,
wait,
not
I
Antichrist.
I feel like we're willfully misreading Antichrist now. what's happening? I tuned out for like 1 second.
We're
all of a sudden you're throwing Lars
you,
von Trier under the bus. I mean, Lars von Trier is a giant troll.
Oh, absolutely.
He is like Troll 2, whatever the fuck the subtitle of that movie was.
He's always sympathized with Nazis, David.
Right, but he's also a complete genius. So, I mean, again, it's about finding the line.
Channeling the trolling.
I think it's just better if people are aware and try to be specifically aware of what's going on before they engage. Because I think if you could spot trolling, like, it's not always something that you have to disqualify as invalid, but it's not always something you have to engage with. It's just like, it's there to make you feel angry so you don't think. So the best thing you could do is think about it before you do something.
Just be ready to engage it beyond the trolling comment, I think is important. I often see people troll one statement and then they can't stop repeating that statement. And that's not helpful. That's pointless trolling. Trolling and then taking people on in conversation, that is worthwhile.
Yeah, or follow up. And if you hold people to their opinions for long enough, they will find things they disagree with, usually.
So, Dave, I'm going to watch your Twitter feed and make sure you do this.
I mean, Brave was beautifully animated. It just wasn't the best animated picture of the year.
Oh, my God. I'm still... Well, I guess when people are hearing this, the Oscars will have already happened. If Brave has won an Oscar by the time you hear this, I hope that Dave is cowering in a corner somewhere.
No, man, they should. I'm changing some fates.
They should really abstain from just holding the Oscar for Best Animated Feature category this year.
What, anyway. Paranorman's in there? Shut up.
But only looks good by a matter of contrast. Anyway, let's wrap this up.
Done.
We can't help but fall into the trap. We can't end things.
We've trolled ourselves. And as long as I've got my suit and tie, I'm gonna leave it all on the floor tonight. And you got fixed up to the nines. Let me show you a good thing. Okay, that does it for this week's Operation Kino. We'll be back on Friday with our review segment about Stoker. And in the meantime, tell the people who you are.
At Patches, I'm the movies editor of Hollywood.com. Find me on Twitter at Mr. M-I-S-T-E-R Patches. And remember, to answer our lightning round question, go to Twitter, message us at @opkino, and tell us your answer.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film editor of Film.com. And you can find me on Twitter at @FilmDotCom and at David Ehrlich in our right-hand corner. And at @opkino. But also on iTunes, we would love to hear what you think about the show, especially if it is positive, because good reviews will help us find new listeners, and you can throw in some constructive criticism in there, too, if you really must, because we'd also like to improve all the time.
Hey, it's me, Dave with a 7 again. You can find me on Twitter at @DA7E and at DA7E.com, and come join us on Facebook at facebook.com/opkino. Where I will post the drawings that I did today of all of us that got totally rejected by the rest of us.
Wow. Wow. I'm Katie Rich. You can find me here at Cinema Blend or on Twitter at Katie Rich, KATEYRICH. And you can also leave us a message like the one that you heard earlier in the show. Suggest us topics, give us feedback, whatever you want to do. The number is 914-410-6450.
Now accepting trolling.
We can counter troll, though, be forewarned.
Counter troll.
We will find you. Pieces of life.